You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
There have been unprecedented calamities in global financial markets over the past several years. At the same time, we've experienced extreme weather with alarming frequency, disastrous hurricanes like Katrina and Sandy, and environmental disasters like the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. In her new book, Environmental Debt, The Hidden Costs of a Changing Global Economy, Amy Larkin argues that the global economy is inextricably linked to our relationship with nature, and how, if we hope to leave a better world for our children and grandchildren, we must develop a new framework, a new way of thinking, and a new way of doing business. Ms. Larkin, the former Solutions Director for Greenpeace USA, runs the consulting firm Nature Means Business and is the chair of the advisory board of Biomimicry New York City, or NYC. Her book is published by Palgrave Macmillan. I'm very pleased to welcome her to our show.
Hello. I'm very pleased to be here. Thank you.
So what is environmental debt?
Environmental debt are the costs that business incurs every time there is a financial transaction that you do not pay for at the pump or at the retail cost for coal, but you pay for as a taxpayer, as an individual, or as another business.
So can you tell us how something like deforestation in Thailand 20 years ago has had a negative impact worldwide?
Well, first of all, back up a second. Every financial transaction has an environmental impact, and the environment is embedded in every environmental transaction. And our work now is to harmonize the two so that the financial and environmental laws work together. In Thailand, almost 20 years ago, there was a raft of deforestation. And
it's the reason why we have so much good teak furniture available today.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so in 2011, when there were massive floods in Thailand, which effectively shut the country down, there wasn't enough topsoil and ground to hold the water. So what would have been a terrible flood anyway became a catastrophic flood. The impact of that 20 years later was, after the deforestation, was that tens of thousands of workers lost jobs in Kentucky, Singapore, and Philippines because the Toyota factories in Thailand were unable to produce the parts. So you and I paid unemployment insurance for workers in Kentucky from deforestation that occurred almost 20 years ago.
So the rules of cause and effect know no borders.
No borders nor time frame.
What is the environmental cost of fossil fuels throughout the world? We hear a lot about
it
mostly in negative ways, and yet we're unwilling to change our ways.
Well, I think the true cost of fossil fuels is very hard to measure. So China recently measured the cost of environmental damages as 3.5% of its GDP. That was not just fossil fuels. That was the poison in rivers that makes...
But it's also impossible, I gather, to breathe in Beijing some days.
I think it's most days impossible to breathe in Beijing. And the cost of... The real problem is that every time you get in a car or on an airplane or buy something made with petroleum, you are contributing to extreme weather. You are contributing to ocean acidification. Connecting those things is really hard to do.
People who deny, we'll get to the deniers later, point out that there's always been extreme weather.
Absolutely, there's been extreme weather, but the amount of carbon loaded into the atmosphere has altered the speed at which things are changing. So the word glacial means slow. So, and that's because the changes in glaciers are slow. And at the turn of the 20th century, when Glacier National Park was declared a park by Theodore Roosevelt, there were 150 glaciers there. Today, there are 24. That is not a glacial change.
How important a role does coal play in this? It's always referred to as an inexpensive energy source. So how cheap is it?
Oh, it is not cheap at all. So I was part of a study done by Harvard called Full Cost Accounting of Coal. And it was largely led by Harvard, but with our participation, we measured the costs of water damage, of boom and bust cycles, of lost arable land, lost ecosystems, extreme weather costs, climate, you name it, up and down the food chain, from mining to combustion. And just in the U.S., it's about $400 billion. So $400 billion is a third of the 2012 American deficit. Other studies have shown that the true cost of oil just in the U.S., and these aren't that current, they're 5 and 6 years old, they show that the true cost of oil in the U.S. is about $800 billion. You add those two things together, they come to more than a 2012 deficit.
Why haven't biofuels become the great solution?
Well, biofuels is a way to have food and energy compete. And so biofuels is not such a great solution. However, the little teeny nascent business of transforming in agricultural waste, whether it be manure or other agricultural waste, is in fact an extraordinary opportunity to transform it into transportation fuel. That's actually something the U.S. Army has been working on, and it makes sense that they would work on it, because to bring transportation fuel to far-off places with pipelines and convoys is expensive. But, of course, they were still attacked by the Republican members of Congress for that.
My guest is Amy Larkin. Her book, Environmental Debt, The Hidden Costs of a Changing Global Economy. Well, how can we begin to tackle the issue when so many people in government continue to argue that climate change may not even exist, or if it does, it doesn't have a human source?
Well, one of the very, very optimistic things that I have come across in the last 10 years is that businesses, more and more and more businesses, are ready to stand up and say, this is a major problem. And the reason is, when there's extreme weather, you are in big trouble if you have to predict what cotton or wheat is going to cost. And so businesses more and more are saying to government, we must have a price on carbon.
But at the same time, most of the people in Congress cite business as a reason for opposing any change. Most of the climate change deniers in Congress come from states where fossil fuels are an important part of the economy. The people who who argue against changing deforestation rules come from states where there's a lot of trees, or used to be a lot of trees.
Well, I think that there is a split in the business world. And what I hope will happen, and one of the things I hope my book will help do, is unleash those business people who are fierce in what they believe about the environment, and they will bring their companies to, in fact, be strong, loud advocates.
One argument is that we tend to think in this country in terms of quarterly rather than long term. And so when people from coal mining states argue that this is that any changes in the rules are going to hurt the states, they're thinking short term, aren't they?
Well, they are thinking short term, but in fact, in the state of Kentucky,
Mitch McConnell state,
that very state,
Rand Paul,
the Mountain Area Community Economic Development Corporation did a study on the actual costs for the Kentucky state budget of coal. And I think the year was 2008, maybe 2009. It showed that the state actually lost $115 million. So that's not even looking long-term. In terms of long-term, every state... Let's go close to home. Hurricane Sandy is going to have a $100 billion price tag. The direct line between climate change and Hurricane Sandy is very clear. The big problem from that hurricane was the surge, which was caused by warm water. It wasn't even a hurricane when it hit hit us. It was a superstorm. So we know that that $100 billion, for a huge amount of it, was in fact caused by carbon loading of the atmosphere.
How much does the United States spend each year on cleanups, recovery, and rebuilding after an environmental disaster, not just Sandy, but environmental disasters like Sandy?
Well,
because we have had flooding, we've had droughts.
Right. In the book, I have several charts from a variety of insurance companies, and I don't have the numbers exactly here, but I know post-Katrina, it was about $250 billion a year for extreme weather, and post-Sandy, I think it's going to be about $150, $175 billion. It's real money, and it is not the full costs. That's the other thing. When you look at what are the immediate costs, that's one piece. But in fact, Hurricane Sandy, we are rebuilding. We're going to have to rebuild a lot of that again. All of this is being put back in harm's way.
There's still a debate in New Jersey as to whether to knock down many of the vulnerable houses and rebuild, or just hope that we don't have another Sandy.
Well, there are two very clear messages going. One is there's a $700 million pot of money from New York and New Jersey to buy up your house. We know that's the right thing to do. And then there is a $30 billion pot of federal, it's all federal money in this case, $30 billion pot where it's for rebuilding.
Now, there was a report this very morning on Morning Edition here from the WMIC newsroom, which they looked at what has been happening in New Jersey. And when Governor Christie came into office, he got rid of a lot of the people in the department that deals with issues like potential environmental disasters and brought in business people. And the head of that department said that but then they and they wrote out they eliminated all of the dire warnings in all of the reports. The head of the department said, well, you know, who would you rather have dealing with real life issues? People from business and real estate, people who understand how things work? Or do you want to have some academic who's in some ivory tower school?
I would like both. I have great respect for business people. I think that being an executive is a tough job, and you need people who will make hard decisions. But if you don't listen to scientists, you're not going to make very good decisions.
But also what you've been suggesting is that, to some degree, this is a war of the accountants. Accountants who say, listen, we are going to cut back on our profitability, as opposed to accountants who are saying we're going to hurt ourselves in the long run.
Well, here's the amazing thing. It's the biggest accounting firms in the world saying both. I mean, it's akin to what we talked before a second ago about New York and New Jersey having a mixed message. So PricewaterhouseCoopers created an environmental profit and loss statement for Puma, and it showed that if they had paid their true costs of their environmental damages, it would have cut into 72%. Of their profit.
So Puma decided to go the environmental
route. Well, no, because the current rules of business means that if Puma did that, every other business that is a bigger polluter would make a bigger profit.
Now, you have some nice things to say about Walmart in your book, but we have a call from Frank from Manhattan who has some negative things to say. Hi, Frank.
Hi there. Yes, Walmart has been for several decades the largest importer of palletized freight from China. These pallets are made of untreated lumber, and in that untreated lumber has brought to North America the emerald ash borer and the Asian longhorn beetle. These two pests will decimate. They have moved from the West Coast to the East Coast and are affecting trees. And these two pests will ultimately decimate the North American forest product industry. And so Walmart is a very profitable business, but the consequential damage that their business model costs have been shifted off to other people's balance sheets. They will destroy the forest product industry in North America, and we will, of course, get to pay for the retraining or the unemployment of people in those industries, as well as having to find substitutes for wood, which is something that can be regrown and replanted. But the pests, that is the beetles, know boundaries. So we have a serious, serious problem, and North America is probably the largest producer of wood products in the world,
Frank,
much of it for export.
Thank you so much for your call,
well,
Amy.
I'm not familiar with this particular issue, but let's presume what Frank is saying is correct. I think that that is exactly why the accounting rules have to change, so that, number one, pollution can no longer be free or subsidized, and number two, the long view must guide all decision-making and accounting, so that if, in fact, what you say is correct, which I don't doubt, in fact, the people who are using those pellets and importing those bugs, in fact, should be responsible. I would completely concur.
My guest is Amy Larkin, who was the Solutions Director for Greenpeace USA for 6 years until 2011. Since then, through her consulting firm Nature Means Business, she has worked with Greenpeace, Peace International, Consumer Goods Forum, and the Agricultural Sustainability Institute of UC Davis. She's chair of the advisory board of Biomimicry NYC, a strategic advisor to resolve the D.C.-based experts on building negotiated solutions to intractable public policy issues, and also the chair of the board of the Archive of Contemporary Music, which is a whole other issue.
A whole other issue, yes.
We'll get to some other time when you visit us to talk about music. Right now, we're talking about the environment. Her book is Environmental Debt, The Hidden Costs of a Changing Global Economy. It is published by Palgrave Macmillan. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Amy Larkin, whose book, Environmental Debt, The Hidden Costs of a Changing Global Economy, is published by Palgrave Macmillan. What are your thoughts on Mayor Bloomberg's call for a $20 billion system of flood barriers to protect New York's low-lying areas from storms?
Well, I think that I would have to be convinced. I think it's going to be hard to convince me that it will work. I think that if, in fact, we do build flood barriers, the impact of trying to successfully maneuver the ocean is an extraordinarily intense amount of hubris.
But they've done something like this in the Netherlands, for example.
They have done something like this in the Netherlands, except it has not been as broad a coastal oceanfront. It has not been a lot of the Netherlands that is protected is much more inland, and I would love to see the engineering studies and ask a lot of questions.
Is there much innovation happening when it comes to developing solutions for widespread damage of the sort we saw with Sandy?
You know, one of my favorite stories from Sandy is what happened at Cape May, where for many years before Sandy, the Nature Conservancy worked with the local area to create natural resiliencies. So they built up the water, the sand, they built up the water with feeding it with oysters and other things that will strengthen the area, the coastal area, naturally, using what is naturally a barrier. And in fact, Cape May was spared quite a bit. It didn't have nearly the damage of anything nearby. So the thing that we don't really want to hear is that, in fact, a lot of what has to happen is painstaking and natural occurrence as opposed to big engineering marvels. And I think that this goes back to our view of nature. Nature is a force. It is the greatest force in the world. And as strong as we are, as smart as we are, as extraordinarily ambitious and thrilling as our achievements are, nature is the power.
Well, it's easy to blame people in power for some of our problems, but aren't we also responsible? For example, I'm thinking about the areas where the communities were willing to spend a little money to build up sand dunes on their beaches and others that resisted because it took away the view.
Well, what I always say is that our job is to connect the rules of business and the laws of nature and harmonize them. And if you think that your view is more important than everything else around it, and you want the rest of us to pay for recovering your house, your car, your infrastructure because you want to keep your view, you can keep your view, but you can pay for it.
Well, I would think that what you're arguing here to some degree is that when businesses look at the dividends from thinking in a more green way, they actually are adding to their profit, their profits. But businesses, most businesses don't see it that
well,
way.
But the big reason is because the rules of business are backwards. So a perfect example is PepsiCo. It built an extraordinary state-of-the-art factory in Arizona a few years ago. It was near net zero energy, waste, and water. Amazing achievements, brilliant engineering, and they are unable to deploy all of those breakthroughs globally because they're more expensive. They save money within 5 years, but because they have to invest good, smart investment, their quarterly or even annual results don't look as good. In 5 years, they'll be way ahead of the game, but that's not how our business world works, how Wall Street works. And so, in fact, if senior management were to spend the money as they should, they'd be out.
My guest is Amy Larkin. Her book, Environmental Debt, The Hidden Costs of a Changing Global Economy. It's published by Palgrave Macmillan. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. The fight often is political, whether government should get involved or not. How much of it is based on political ideology? For example, the Koch brothers are in the energy business, but they also come out of a politically conservative family tradition that just believes that the government should not get involved in this sort of thing.
Well, I think if they believe that the government should not get involved, then they should pay for every single piece of the cleanup of every bit of their oil operations, every bit of environmental impact from their oil operations. And then we will have some version of a market-level playing field. But we're not even close to that. Our market has no relationship to real costs. That is the true environmental debt, that all these polluting and damaging actions cost other parties real money in the future.
What happened to the green initiatives that were part of then-candidate Obama's agenda when he ran for president in 2008?
He came into a terribly partisan environment, and frankly, my biggest disappointment with President Obama from his first term was that when he had an army of 2 million people, euphoric, he didn't give us something to do. And I think had he said to the United States populace, we are going to lower our energy use by 10% in the next year, we would have done it because people wanted something to do. And I think that it is still not too late to do that. I think that I have been, frankly, very disappointed in Obama's.
Well, he did come up with a recent National Climate Action Plan.
Yes, he did.
And there was a hue and cry as a result. It's a rather modest one.
I think that for certainly the greatest orator we've had in a long time, to speak to the nation about the importance of energy conservation, change in climate approach, the real cost of global warming and climate change. I think we could do a lot more and a lot better. And I actually think that there are a lot of businesses who would stand up with him, and nobody has tried to bring them in to state, okay, what will you really do?
Well, many say that the most effective method is cap and trade, but that's pretty much a dead issue in American politics.
Well, I think that the really sneaky, interesting thing coming in the back door are these accounting rule changes. So 2 years ago, the SEC put forward sort of a flare. They raised the flare that businesses were going to have to state their climate change risk. They were going to have to disclose them. And when you read the SEC ruling, it's sort of not clear. You read it a second time. What exactly do you mean? Where is the verb in here? It's not quite clear. It was a flare to test what, in fact, would be financially necessary to report. I think that this is, again, accountants are doing this very strange, heroic work. So there are changes in accounting rules being discussed globally amongst all of the large accounting firms and a huge number of governments and civil society organizations.
Can you explain the nature means business framework?
Yes, I think that there are basically three guidelines that will cover all of the changes needed for business. The first one is pollution can no longer be free. The second one is the long view is necessary to guide all decision making. And the third one is that government plays a vital role in catalyzing clean technology and growth. And it's very popular to blame government and hate government, but current technologies that we use today, particularly the internet and computers, were spurred by government funding and government R&D. They wouldn't exist without them.
A number of listeners have written in and called. Tori from Westchester asks, how is it methane is not being used in transportation as it is commonly in Europe?
I think that in the United States, we are honestly behind on a huge amount of technologies that are in use in Europe. And Europe seems to have governments, politicians, businesses, but also a public that is more attuned to the science. They are more accustomed to believing scientists.
Germany has made a major commitment to solar energy, for example. You see solar panels
everywhere. Same in Belgium.
Another caller responded to the first caller's comments about Walmart's wooden shipping pallets. Says in Europe, they pioneered reusable shipping pallets that cause less solid waste. So, but the question, I guess, from a listener that pertains the most is businesses may have to change, but what about our consumer habits?
You know, this is something that I talk about in the book. If you want to buy cheap meat, cheap T-shirts, cheap computers, cheap gizmos, cheap. We buy everything cheap, including our gasoline. That's because we are not paying for their real costs, whether it be, you know, terrible working conditions in Bangladesh or the 3.5% of China's GDP that they ascribe to environmental damages. 25% of China's exports are to the United States. So a lot of that money and damage is caused by our consumption.
Ironically, Leonard from New Jersey points out when he worked for an exporting company and they shipped stuff to China, they were required to use treated lumber pallets. He says, is this a one-way street? So do we have reason for optimism? Many people feel that as far as climate change is concerned, we have gone past the tipping point.
I hope they're wrong, and I've spoken to many scientists who believe that. But I have to hope they're wrong, and that does not leave us any choice but to do everything we can to try to change the course.
At least to slow it down.
To slow it down. There will be extreme weather no matter what we do over the next generation.
So you talk to a lot of people in government and in business. How do they react to what you say?
In business?
Amy, this is really interesting. Great. I'll read your book.
Well, actually, the people in business are much braver, clearer than the people in government. Because the people, as I said before, if you are in business and you need to be responsible for a profit projection and there's a flood in Pakistan, a heat wave in Ukraine, or a drought in the Midwest, you are in trouble. So they know very clearly what are the problems, or you need water for your business and there's a shortage of it because people need drinking water. Businesses know that. Government is not even close to reckoning. Not even close. And I think until either we as the people rise up and make enough noise, or businesses more likely stand up and say, we are ready to do the hard work. Otherwise, our politicians are not listening.
Well, we do elect them.
We do.
And to some degree, they vote the way they do because they think that's going to get them reelected.
Correct. It's a very sad thing.
Amy Larkin's book, Environmental Debt, The Hidden Costs of a Changing Global Economy, is published by Palgrave Macmillan. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you, Leonard.